That was the truth as Rafik saw it, and he didn't waste energy picking that truth apart. His was a Hobbesian world where distrust was a given, and loyalties extended from family to mosque to the black race, whereupon notions of loyalty ceased to apply. This narrowing vision of blood and tribe had provided Rafik with a clarity of sorts, a means of focusing his attention. Black self-respect had delivered the mayor's seat, he could argue, just as black self-respect turned around the lives of drug addicts under the tutelage of the Muslims. Progress was within our grasp, so long as we didn't betray ourselves. But what exactly constituted betrayal? Ever since the first time I'd picked up Malcolm X's autobiography, I tried to untangle the twin strands of black nationalism, arguing that nationalism's affirming message of solidarity and self-reliance, discipline and communal responsibility, need not depend on hatred of whites, any more than it depended on white munificence. We could tell this country where it was wrong, I would tell myself and any black friends who would listen, without ceasing to believe in its capacity for change. In talking to self-professed nationalists like Rafik, though, I came to see how the blanket indictment of everything white served a central function in their message of uplift, how psychologically, at least, one depended on the other. For when the nationalist spoke of a reawakening of values as the only solution to black poverty, he was expressing an implicit, if not explicit, criticism to black listeners that we did not have to live as we did. And while there were those who could take such an unadorned message and use it to hew out a new life for themselves, those with the stolid dispositions that Booker T. Washington had once demanded from his followers, in the ears of many blacks, such talk smacked of the explanations that whites had always offered for black poverty, that we continued to suffer from, if not genetic inferiority, then cultural weakness. It was a message that ignored causality or fault, a message outside history, without a script or plot that might insist on progression. For a people already stripped of their history, a people often ill-equipped to retrieve that history in any form other than what fluttered across the television screen, the testimony of what we saw every day seemed only to confirm our worst suspicions about ourselves. Black nationalism provided that history, an unambiguous morality tale that was easily communicated and easily grasped. A steady attack on the white race, the constant recitation of black people's brutal experience in this country, served as the ballast that could prevent the ideas of personal and communal responsibility from tipping into an ocean of despair. Yes, the nationalists would say, whites are responsible for your sorry state, not any inherent flaws in you. In fact, the nationalists would continue, whites are so heartless and devious that we can no longer expect anything from them. The self-loathing you feel, what keeps you drinking or thieving, is planted by them. Rid them from your mind and find your true power liberated. Rise up, ye mighty race. All this was painful to consider, as painful now as it had been years ago. It contradicted the morality my mother had taught me, a morality of subtle distinctions, between individuals of goodwill and those who wished me ill, between active malice and ignorance or indifference. I had a personal stake in that moral framework. I discovered that I couldn't escape it if I tried. As it turned out, though, it was questions of effectiveness and not sentiment that caused most of my quarrels with Rafik. Once, after a particularly thorny meeting with the city, I asked Rafik whether he could turn out his followers if a public showdown with the city became necessary. I don't got time to run around passing out flyers trying to explain everything to the public, Rafik said. Most of the folks out here don't care one way or another. The ones that do, going to be double-crossing Negroes trying to mess things up. Important thing is to get our plan tight and get the city signed on. That's how stuff gets done, not with a big crowd and noise and all that. Once we get a done deal, then y'all announce it any way you like. I disagreed with Rafik's approach. For all his professed love of black people, he seemed to distrust them an awful lot. But I also knew his approach was dictated by a lack of capacity. Neither his organization nor his mosque, I had discovered, could claim a membership of more than 50 persons. His influence arose not from any strong organizational support, but from his willingness to show up at every meeting that remotely affected Roseland and shout his opponents into submission. What held true for Rafik was true throughout the city, without the concentrating effect of Harold Washington's campaign. Nationalism dissipated into an attitude rather than any concrete program, a collection of grievances and not an organized force. Images and sound that crowded the airwaves and conversation, but without any corporal existence.